Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Scam artists often take advantage of people when they are most vulnerable and many times are clever enough to develop schemes during a crisis. As more people seek treatment for drug and alcohol dependency, there are group homes located outside Pennsylvania that don't come through with what it's promised, mislead patients, and leave them with huge bills. To talk more about it today is Jennifer Smith, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Secretary Smith, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us is Jessica Altman, Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner. Commissioner Altman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be back.
If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Smith, a fraud on people who are suffering and many times desperate. What's happening?
Sure. So you know how bad the epidemic here is in Pennsylvania, and a lot of people are just trying to figure out how to get into some kind of treatment program. So when they make that final decision to say, yep, I need help, how do you get me where I need to go?
Which is a big decision.
It is a big decision. So when they make that decision, you want to make sure that you're getting them in quickly and that you're getting them into a quality provider. Unfortunately, what's happening is because they don't know where to go for treatment, they're pulling up the internet, perhaps typing into Google treatment provider in Pennsylvania or treatment provider. And they'll see images that come up of these beautiful spa-like entities that have, you know, pristine rooms with double beds and beautiful views. And a lot of those facilities, when you dig into it, say that they're located in places like Florida, California, Arizona. Those are just some examples. So the treatment sounds great, and they call the number, and they get themselves hooked up with these facilities. Unfortunately, when they arrive in those states, what they find there is not what they saw in the image on the internet. And Jessica can talk a little bit more about what happens in terms of the insurance perspective. But the reality is that these folks are just seeking a place to get treatment, but they're ending up at places that really don't deliver quality treatment, but instead are really looking to get the biggest bang for their buck from these clients who are coming to them.
So just to be clear, before we talk about the insurance aspect of it, just to be clear, are they actually getting treatment?
In some cases, yes, but in many cases, no. A lot of times what it will end up being is some kind of sober home or a recovery house where there is no treatment provided there, but it's just a place for them to live. So that's another issue, that they're promising things that they can't make good on.
So just a place to live. I mean, once a person gets there and sees that, hey, there's no treatment here. We've talked about this many times. Detox is one of the first steps in a recovery. This just sounds like one long detox. Is there any moves made in some of these places where it's just a house to live to actually help a person to get rid of their addiction, to stop their addiction at that point, and then mm-hmm. treatment? I mean, can't they make the decision that, hey, this is not what I signed up for, I'm out of here?
Sure, they could if they knew well enough to make that decision.
Okay, that's what I was getting
at.
But
you have to remember that addiction is a disease and it affects the chemicals in the brain. So when you are in active addiction, your brain is not functioning the same way that an average person's brain would function. So your reasoning and logic and ability to make decisions like that are often impaired. So it'd be very difficult for them to really get in that scenario and know that the scenario they're in is not exactly what treatment is supposed to look like.
Yeah, most people wouldn't recognize it. They figure that nice website, they must know what they're doing.
Yep.
I am sure that they have in their advertising or their marketing testimonials of whether they're real or not, of people who have successfully gone through the treatment.
Yeah, Yeah. And so there is a movement nationwide, and Florida is one of the states that is doing similar to what Pennsylvania is doing in implementing some legislation that will require oversight of these entities that we call recovery houses here in Pennsylvania. Some states call them sober homes, but they are places to live where individuals can live together in a drug and alcohol-free environment, but they don't necessarily receive treatment. So once states start implementing this idea of either certifying or licensing these entities, I think we'll start seeing a reduction in this type of fraudulent activity, but it's going to take some time to get there.
Well, I understand that part of the challenge right now is that there aren't a lot of federal regulations, or at least it's difficult for states and local governments to crack down because of some federal regulations.
Yeah, in terms of the recovery housing, there aren't any federal regulations around that space. So that's why states are looking to pass legislation that gives them the authority to regulate those entities. The real challenge for states is that many of these recovery homes or sober homes pop up all across the state. And so we don't really have a good handle on even how many of these entities exist. We know for sure that there are over 1,000 in the Philadelphia area alone. So we're definitely looking at thousands total across the state of Pennsylvania, but we don't really have a good quantity for that. So the best place that we're starting is to look at certifying homes that receive any kind of federal or state dollars. That's the easiest place for us to start because we know who those entities are. They're receiving our money. And hopefully once we get the regulations in place for those entities and begin certifying them and working through that process, we'll begin to get a better understanding on the other entities that exist that don't necessarily receive state and federal dollars but are accepting money from private individuals. Often it's parents who are putting a second mortgage out on their home or, you know, people taking loans from their family and friends to help pay for these things. So I think we'll get a better handle on it eventually. But like I said, it is going to take some time.
Now, you just mentioned the Philadelphia area. Mm-hmm. I have to say that I was under the impression that you were trying to get people to stop visiting these places out of state in Florida, Arizona, California, all warm weather states. So, yeah. I mean, the ones in the Philadelphia region, I mean, are we talking legitimate recovery homes or just what?
There absolutely are some legitimate homes in the Philadelphia area. There are lots of them across Pennsylvania, actually. And there really are legitimate recovery houses in other states, too, including California, Arizona, and Florida.
Right, right.
I think what Jessica and I are trying to do is warn people about being very cautious when you're selecting one of these entities and make sure that you know what you're getting into, make a few phone calls. Maybe you want to go visit it before you commit to entering the entity.
So, Commissioner Altman, I have been referring to these entities as group homes, and I noticed that Secretary Smith didn't use that term, because I have to admit that when you hear group homes, there are a lot of different kinds of group homes, treatment for a lot of different ailments, illnesses, you know, people who actually do get some help depending on what they're suffering from. But from what I understand with these places that we're talking about, that insurance is a real issue because, number one, group homes, I'm going to use that term for now, that insurance doesn't pay for that. That's one. And they try to get around that, and we'll talk about that. But some of these bills that are coming in to patients are just outlandish. So talk about the insurance aspect of it.
Sure. So insurance is actually really one of the areas where we can see red flags, where things that happen related to your insurance may tip you off that where you're going to live or seek treatment may not be what you think you're getting into. Now, on one hand, it is actually a red flag if I will call them recovery homes.
All right. We'll have all kinds
of
terms
here. I use
Jen's
terminology.
All right. I'll start doing that, I promise.
These recovery homes, they generally don't provide medical services. They are a place to live they are a safe place to live where you know you will not be in an environment where you are around drugs or the type of behaviors that may have brought you to drugs. But because they don't provide medical care themselves, they generally can't bill your medical insurance. And what we have seen is these homes are either saying you don't have to pay because we do bill your insurance, or just you don't have to pay at all. And that's really a red flag. And it's so important if that happens that you then say, okay, who is paying for this? What we've seen in some of these unfortunate cases when unscrupulous entities are involved is that there is a relationship between the recovery home and a medical provider that may be doing lab testing or other related services. And somewhere money is flowing to the recovery home, even though it's not from the patient and certainly not from their insurer. Now, on the other side, we do sometimes see really exorbitant bills for services, whether it is getting a urine test, for example, every single day, or exorbitant charges for those tests. So, for example, Medicare typically pays about $80 for an initial screening test, between $100 and $250 for confirmation tests. But we've seen scammers bill up to $4,000 for those same tests. And in fact, Jen and I were recently speaking about this, and we're joined by a woman named Liz DeWolf, who unfortunately lost her son in one of these circumstances. And she ended up receiving a bill for $250,000 for simply lab tests.
Just for lab tests?
For lab tests.
Tell her story, if you would, because, I mean, this is one of the horror stories of this.
Yeah. So I'll let Jen jump in if she wants. But her son, his name was JJ, and he had received treatment in Florida before and thought he would go back. He didn't know where to go. He got a recommendation from some friends. We're living in this place. It's great. We're near the beach. Sounds wonderful. Let's get out of Pennsylvania in that cold winter that you referenced and go down there. He lived in a home. He was getting constant testing. The bills were going to the insurance company, and then the insurance company said, we don't think these bills are legitimate. We're going to stop paying. Sometime around that time, he was prescribed for something totally unrelated. I believe it was steroids. Mm-hmm. And you're not allowed to have any drugs in the recovery home. But he did the right thing. He went to the home and he said, I have these steroids. I'm not abusing them. I need them for a different medical condition. And there was didn't seem to be a problem. But sometime around, and Liz would say, coincidentally, when the insurance stopped paying for the medical bills, they said, oh, you have another medication. You can no longer stay here. Pack your things and go. And unfortunately, within the next 24 hours, he had overdosed in his vehicle.
Mm. So kind of walk me through what went wrong there. I mean, obviously, that was worst case scenario. But I guess one of the things I'm kind of struggling with here when we're talking about this, I've used the word scams and you've used the word fraudulent. This is not your typical scam. Hey, you've won the lottery, you know, send us money. We'll, you'll keep sending us money and you'll get it back. But is it accurate to describe this as a scam?
I think it is. And I certainly think what it is often is taking advantage of a person in a vulnerable position who is looking for anywhere they can to get help and using their insurance status as the mechanism for getting a ton of money, quite frankly. And perhaps one thing that's indicative is, generally speaking, the providers in question, if you have public insurance, if you have medical assistance, they won't fly you down to Florida. They won't give you a place to live in a recovery home. It is generally within the commercial health insurance that tends to pay more for billed services.
And that's one of the promises that many of them make in these out-of-state warm weather sites, is that free airfare, close to the beach, that kind of thing. That sounds like a vacation.
It does.
That doesn't sound like recovery treatment.
And one of the things we definitely advise is, if someone is paying for your treatment, paying for your transportation, they can always stop paying. And you need to make sure that you have the ability to get to where you need to be in those cases. So if you are going to fly to Florida, and especially if you're going to do so on someone else's dime, make sure you have the resources so that you can get home if that's what you need to do. Because we have unfortunately heard of cases where people get stranded in other states absent the resources to get them back home.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Jennifer Smith, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. We're talking about some fraudulent recovery homes, many located out of state in Florida, Arizona, California, that make a lot of promises. Often they don't come through, and they mislead patients, leave them with some huge bills, try to take advantage of their insurance status, too. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to follow up, Commissioner Altman, on something you said just before the break. You said that often they're taking advantage of the person's commercial insurance. How often are these people being treated with commercial, and they have commercial insurance? In other words, through a either Obamacare or through having an employer pay their insurance.
Sure. So we did a survey of our commercial health insurers, and the results we got account for about 70% of our commercial health insurance market. And of that group, about 7,000 Pennsylvanians have received out-of-state treatment for addiction between 2016 and 2017. That's actually one in six of people who received treatment during that time. So that's a really high number of people. We also saw 2,700 alone out of that number go to Florida. Now, there are absolutely reputable places to receive treatment.
Right, I wanted to make that
point.
State. Yeah.
And many people in Pennsylvania, they're seen, they go over the border to Ohio or Maryland or Delaware. Yeah. But that's actually far fewer than we're going to these warmer states and in particular Florida. So what we do know is a large number of people who are receiving treatment are doing so out of state. And then anecdotally, we know that some of them are unfortunately not receiving the treatment they deserve.
Palm Beach County in Florida. I remember 60 Minutes a few years ago did a piece on Palm Beach County being the recovery capital of the world. I don't know exactly the terminology used, that there are so many treatment centers, some legit, some not, in Palm Beach County. Are Pennsylvanians going there?
Yeah, I don't have statistics on where in Florida they're going, but I would certainly guess that there are a number going there. And once again, a number going to reputable places for treatment, and unfortunately, a number not.
You know, I'm curious about how this marketing goes on, Secretary Smith, because, as you said, first of all, you know, let's face it, nowadays, for convenience sake, and it's our first turn to going to Google.
Yeah.
But something as serious as trying to recover from an addiction or dependency, to go to Google, it's just one of those things that people, you just don't have a knowledge of. I mean, if I'm going to buy a car, right, I have a good idea where I'm going to go. But for, trying to recover from an addiction, it's not exactly, unless you do hear by word of mouth, something that you know of offhand. So a lot of people would go to Google. So describe what some of these sites look like, because I do know you have some tips here of some things to look out for, but what do they look like?
Yeah, so first I'll start by explaining a little bit about how Google searches contributed to the scam, and then I'll circle back with where people can actually go to find reputable treatment facilities. So we heard a couple of years ago, we started to hear some reports that when individuals would Google a treatment provider in Pennsylvania, the name of a licensed drug and alcohol treatment provider that's in Pennsylvania would come up along with their address. But when you would dial the telephone number on that Google search, you actually wouldn't get to the treatment provider that was listed.
Now that's an out-and-out scam there.
Yeah. So you'd get a hold of some company who, through asking you some questions, would filter out the people who have private insurance versus the individuals who have either Medicaid or other state funding. So if you had Medicaid or state funding, they would hang up or tell you, oh, well, you have to find another treatment provider. But if you had private insurance, then of course they were starting offering to make arrangements for you. And then it would come to light that, oh, we're not actually in Pennsylvania. We're located in fill in the blank, but oftentimes Florida. So Google was made aware of that issue, and they made some changes to their website to help ensure that those numbers weren't going to be hijacked. So I won't say that the problem has completely gone away, but I have heard much less about that happening in recent history. And so to avoid any potential of accidentally happening upon one of these instances where you're getting a hold of an entity other than the provider, the best thing to do is one of two things. Either to go on our department's website and go to the Get Help Now link that then has a search capability for you to type in a zip code, a county, of a place that you're looking for treatment. And the website will return to you all of our licensed drug and alcohol treatment facilities with the appropriate phone number for you to call. So that would be one option. The other option would be to contact your single county authority. The single county authority is the local drug and alcohol authority within your county. So if you go on your county's webpage, you can probably find it pretty quickly. It's also located on our website. If you type in single county authority, you'll be able to search for your county. And that entity can really help you navigate the system, regardless of what kind of funding source you have, regardless of where you'd like to seek treatment or what kind of treatment you're looking to seek. So those are two really great ways to find a reputable entity. And then the third option would be to call our hotline. So 1-800-662-HELP is our 24/7/365 hotline. If you are seeking treatment immediately, they'll do a brief screening for you and then do a warm line connection directly to a treatment provider that fits your needs.
Let's take some phone calls here. Patrick is in York. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, sure. You're on the air.
Great. Thanks. First of all, great topic. Thank you so much for coming in and covering this topic. One thing that I was going to recommend was, on top of the resources you gave, an easy one to remember is the phone number / website 211. It's like 911, but it's a 2. That website / phone number is designed to help people with all sorts of issues, whether it's housing or mental health and substance abuse. Now, I know that often what they'll be able to do is just refer the caller or person on the website to the exact same things that you described, the warm line, the department's website, et cetera. But it's a very easy thing for people to remember that when they're ready to seek help, they can call 211.
All right.
I also wanted to mention that something that really hasn't gone away with Google, they have seemed to taken care of the fraudulent sites that claim to have a legitimate place in state, and then it turns out it's a phone number out of state. But they use a lot of these places in Florida and California and elsewhere. They continue to use meta tags, and they will literally list every state in the country and every major city in those states so that no matter what location you're searching for, and they're paying top dollar for this in terms of search engine optimization, the first three or four places you'll find on Google will almost always be outside of state, even though you're specifically looking for in-state. So the cards seem to be stacked against people that use Google.
Thank you very much for your call. Some good advice there.
Absolutely. Yep, 211 is a great option. Thanks for reminding everyone about that.
And that's, you know, just what he said, though, about the Google options, the top four. Yeah, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how when people are trying to rip other people off, how clever
how
they can be. That's right. If they only apply their creativity to, you know, noble causes, you know. Let's go to Chris in Reading. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a daughter in recovery. She's 5.5 years. Clean and
wonderful.
Congratulations.
I'm very proud of her and very, very happy to hear you talking about this topic. I do want to say, though, that there are good, reputable programs out there. And when we finally sent her out to California, they took what my insurance paid and they never, ever billed me for a cent. I got really nervous when I saw the explanation of benefits coming in from my insurance company and my part that I owed. And I started to panic, and I called them, and they never billed me for a penny outside of what my insurance paid.
Well,
so,
that's good.
So, do your homework. Go to, you know, reputable sources. Find the information. There are really, really wonderful programs out there, and some of them are out of state.
Hey, I'm just curious, Chris, why California? Why did you decide to go to California, your daughter?
Because they had availability, and my daughter was at Karen, and that was what they recommended. And at that point, I was like, let's get her out there. And, you know, you're willing to do just about anything to help your child. And I think that's something that some of these places take advantage of. And that's really unfortunate. But we had a very good experience.
Well, that's good. Congratulations. Thank you very much. You know, she made a couple points there. One, that, you know, something to, she kind of reiterated what the two of you had said, that many times people are just so desperate and they're willing to do, you know, that first helping hand that, that comes out. And unfortunately, sometimes it is not a reputable one. But she also said, and I don't want this program to make it sound like the majority are, you know, not reputable. The point is, you just kind of have to do some homework, because even though it may be someone may be vulnerable and in a desperate stage in their life, take a few minutes and see what you can find.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to send the message that there are no good facilities in other states or even in Pennsylvania. There are some really great facilities all across the nation. It's just important that you do a little research about them before you go there.
Let's go to Sue in Hummelstown. Sue, you're on the air.
Yes. A few years ago, an acquaintance of mine was in the psychiatric ward at Chambersburg Hospital. And the hospital allowed a representative, a person from a facility in Florida, to be on the premises and market to people who were about to be discharged. And this person was 21 or over, so their parents had no ability to say, you know, you can't go there, we can't afford it, even though the person was still on their insurance. And, of course, they're in a very vulnerable position. They're about to be discharged. And, you know, so they ended up going to Florida. And, yes, it was one of the scam things. And as far as I know, it never was resolved. The family complained to somebody at the state, but as far as I know, they're still getting bills. I mean, is a hospital allowed to do that?
Thank you very much for your call. Good question.
Yeah, so Sue made a really good point here that, that the treatment scams go beyond just Google searches. And so there are entities that will wait literally outside of emergency departments looking for overdose survivors that are being discharged from the hospital and trying to talk with them about coming to their facility. I will say, however, our department put into place a requirement a couple years ago that every hospital have a warm handoff process in place. And a warm handoff process is a facilitated referral from the emergency department into treatment, whatever level of care is appropriate. So hospitals are much, much more aware of the situation. There are now oftentimes people integrated into that emergency department to perform those warm handoff procedures. And those individuals are typically what we call certified recovery specialists. So they are individuals who have lived experience in addiction, and they are really attempting to help these individuals get connected to good, reputable treatment resources. So the hope would be that if someone is looking to get into treatment, that they would actually be connected before they even walk out the door of the emergency department.
How does someone know, though? How does someone know that this is someone who is legitimately and certified trying to help them for that warm handoff, as opposed to someone that Sue just described?
Good question. So in a lot of cases, that individual will be someone affiliated with the hospital. So they'll actually be an employee of the hospital. They would have a name badge, you know, look like they belong. In other cases, it could be an entity from a local treatment provider who's been contracted to do that work. But if that is the case, there should be someone from the hospital present during that discussion. Could be be a social worker, could be a nurse, could be a doctor. So I think the point is awareness again. So if it's a hospital employee, you should be able to trust them. If there's no one in the room from the hospital and it's someone talking to you outside of those parameters, then you should be much more cautious.
Secretary, and when we're talking about scams here, and you say they look like they belong, it doesn't sound like something to go that I'd want to go by, because let's face it, again, people who are trying to scam someone, they look like they belong. They do what they have to do to look like they belong. So the key there is someone from the hospital being there along with them?
Yeah. Ask for identification. Ask the doctor. Ask to see the doctor and have the doctor confirm that this is an individual that the hospital contracts with.
Sue said that this was at the emergency room at Chambersburg Hospital. And I don't want Chambersburg Hospital getting, a black mark here if it's not deserved. So this happens off the premises, outside the emergency room, when these people are approaching someone who...
The examples that we hear about, yes, are happening outside of the emergency department. So sometimes it's people in the parking lot. Sometimes they're sitting on benches right outside of the emergency department. But we don't hear of examples of people actually going into the emergency department and pretending to be, a hospital worker. That doesn't mean it's not happening. But.
So a guy sitting on a bench or in the parking lot approaching you about going to a recovery home probably is a good red flag
That's probably a good flag.
Yeah, that's a good one right there. Let's take a call from Dan in New Cumberland. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. This is a topic near and dear to my heart. I recently moved back to Central Pennsylvania, having lived 26 years in Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville has an amazing program that totally bypasses insurance. It's called the Healing Place. I would encourage you or anybody listening to just go online and look at thehealingplace.org. It's the city's answer to the drug problem. 75% of people who go in the program are sober a year afterward. It's a 6 to 9 month program. There is no cost. It is supported by the city. That kind of program is amazing. It's part of the biggest reason for its success is what happens when you finish the program. There's still a connection with the program and with people who have come through the program, which is often when people are most vulnerable.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for your call. I'm a little nervous about talking about a place. It almost sounds like it's being marketed. Are there places where there's no cost, and even insurance isn't charged to, or a bill sent to an insurance company?
Jessica can speak to it too, but I would say it depends what you're talking about when you say no cost. So
maybe no cost to the patient.
Right. No cost to the patient. So it sounded like, I'm not familiar with the Healing Place, but it sounded the way he was describing it, like perhaps the city, the county, or the state is actually funding the service. And that could be very appropriate. So our department does filter money down through our single county authorities to be a payer of last resort. So if an individual does not have private insurance, is also not enrolled in Medicaid, then our dollars can cover their treatment stay. So there would be no cost to that patient or to their family, but the state would be footing the bill.
Well, as you well are aware, I mean, counties are really facing a huge challenge today during this opioid crisis, because mm-hmm. the counties, for the most part, when someone's not insured or they need a place to go for treatment, often the counties are left holding the bag.
That's right. Now, the good thing is that we've worked really closely with the Department of Human Services, and they have tremendously improved their process for getting folks enrolled in medical assistance. So where it used to be that we might have to cover 2 weeks of a person's treatment stay, that time frame is significantly reduced now. Well, oftentimes it's just a couple of days.
Okay, now wait a minute. I just want to make sure here, because mm-hmm. we've talked about this so often. When I'm hearing 2 weeks, we know that's very, 2 weeks, 14 days is not enough for someone to recover.
Right. No, I'm just talking about in order to get the Medicaid funding turned on.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Not that their stay
okay.
was 2 weeks.
All right. I just
yeah.
wanted to clarify.
I'm
that.
Glad you did.
Yeah, because I don't want people, most people today, they hear 28 days, and we've heard from many people over the years that even 28 days is not enough. I want to go back to Sue, who called a little bit earlier, she said that one of the reasons that her daughter went to California was availability. We have a huge problem in this state and across the country having enough beds, having enough facilities to treat people. Does that play into this fraud?
You know, I would say it probably did a couple of years ago, but that excuse shouldn't hold water anymore. In the last couple of years, we've really expanded access to treatment services. So the governor funded 45 centers of excellence through the Department of Human Services. We've stood up five new models that we call Pennsylvania Coordinated Medication-Assisted Treatment. And those are hub and spoke models where the hub is an addiction medicine specialist within a healthcare network, and the spokes are primary care physicians who are able to provide medication-assisted treatment. They provide the medication portion of it and then refer you for behavioral therapy. We've also received over the last 2 years $52 million from the federal government through the 21st Century Cures Act to expand access to treatment and to pay for individuals' treatment stays. So I would say at this point that accessing treatment shouldn't be nearly as much of a barrier as it may have been a couple of years ago. Now, certainly, it really depends on what level of care the individual is seeking and where they want to go. So it may not be immediately in your backyard. You may need to travel a little ways across the state to get what you need, and sometimes that's not palatable for people. But at the state as a whole, I would say, I think we're doing pretty well in addressing those capacity issues.
I want to talk about another aspect of this, and we'll have Secretary Smith and Commissioner Altman stay with us here in just a few minutes. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and want to take a little bit of a turn here. We have a topic that is related. Number of people admitted to Pennsylvania hospitals to be treated for heroin overdoses increased by almost 13% between 2016 and 2017. And what could be construed as some semi-positive news, that's the lowest increase in recent years. All this is according to a new report released by the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. Joining us is Joe Martin, who is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. Joe Martin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
And we still have Secretary Smith and Commissioner Altman with us, because we're going to, you know, go back and forth with some of these questions. And if you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, Joe Martin. Heroin overdoses, now we're talking about hospitals here in Pennsylvania, increase the overdoses, treatments, increased by almost 13%. As I said, semi-good news. It has slowed down for the first time in a few years. What do those heroin numbers tell you?
Well, what they tell me is that, and combined with the other important finding in this report, which was that the admissions for pain medication overdoses have started to go down. And so, like you said, it's semi-good news. The heroin numbers are still going up. They're going up at a slower rate than they did before. And so I'm cautiously optimistic, I would say, that we're making progress on this issue. The state has done tremendous work on this, both in the public and the private sector. Everyone is focused on this. It's all hands on deck. We need more data. We need better data in order to know if this is a trend or if it's simply an aberration of some sort. One of the things that I've experienced in my healthcare career is healthcare is almost like that whack-a-mole game where you hit the mole down in one spot and another problem pops up. And so the thing that I'm sort of concerned about with this has been the increase in fentanyl in the heroin issue. Because when we look at those heroin numbers, the admissions are going down for heroin over the second part of 2017.
So going down.
They're going
from
down.
Previous years.
Correct.
Okay.
So they went up in they went up 13% over the 2-year period that we looked at, but in the latter part of that reporting period, they were going down. So this is all, you know, cause for, like I said, cautious optimism. However, when we look at the mortality rates for these things, pretty level in terms of pain medication. But the heroin mortality rate went from 3% to 5%. That's a big increase. And it suggests that fewer people are coming in for heroin overdoses. Not sure why exactly. But when they come in, they appear to be in much more serious condition.
So this report does not separate fentanyl and heroin.
We cannot separate fentanyl from heroin because of the way in which it's coded by the hospitals at this point in time. We can separate it within the pain medication issue, and there are legal fentanyl prescriptions for pain medication, but we can't separate it out in the heroin side. And what's even more troubling is that every day there are more derivatives being manufactured of sort of synthetic fentanyl-related types of heroin, if you will. So it's outstripping the ability of toxicologists to really track this on a much more precise level.
So just to kind of backtrack for a moment, it is some good news that overdoses for pain medications actually went down.
Correct.
Not a lot.
That's right.
2%, a little over 2%, but actually did go down.
Yeah. I mean, we might say it was, you know, they've plateaued, but they were going up for quite a few years. But in the interim, we've had the prescription drug monitoring program. We have warm handoffs. We have much more attention being paid to how many prescriptions are being written and so on.
I think doctors overall are more educated, too, about prescribing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that all of these efforts, all of these resources being brought to bear are starting to have an impact. I think it'd be irresponsible to say they weren't having an impact, but how much of an impact, I think, remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. So, Secretary Smith, you're the Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs here in Pennsylvania. When you hear those numbers, what do you think?
So, you know, as Joe said, it's kind of cautious optimism. So I think it's great that in the latter half of 2017, we started to see that decline in admissions. I think the reason that I'm very cautiously optimistic about that is, as Joe pointed out, there is such an increase in fentanyl presence within heroin or other drugs that are being utilized. And so we may not be seeing the hospital admissions because I think we may be seeing more deaths. So people who otherwise would have normally been revived by Narcan, taken by the ambulance to the hospital and admitted and showed up in Joe's report, because of how lethal fentanyl can be and even carfentanil, I think we're seeing more individuals dying on the scene who aren't able to be revived. So I think we have to be careful about getting too excited about the numbers without really putting it in perspective.
If I could just jump in a little bit. So we're all, I think, anxiously awaiting the coroner's numbers will come in at some point this year, which will measure the overall deaths. And so, you know, Jennifer is absolutely correct. And that's why I made my whack-a-mole reference before.
Well, yeah, because that's a good example.
Yeah, we could be
good
you
analogy,
know,
I should say.
We don't want to misconstrue the numbers because of some information that we aren't aware of, and that there's another problem that is unseen at the moment driving this.
And something that should be pointed out is that here in Pennsylvania, you mentioned coroners. That's relatively new, as far as coroners specifically point out a cause of death. Sometimes it just said overdoses. My point being is that we're getting much better information. These numbers, these statistics, yeah, they may just be numbers. There are humans tied to those numbers. But at the same time, those numbers are very important in helping to fight this crisis. Commissioner Altman, I'm curious whether insurance companies and Medicaid, whether this is tracked as well as far as how insurance is spent on overdoses and well, we talked about treatments, but overdoses in particular.
Yeah, the Department of Human Services, which oversees the Medicaid program and or medical assistance, and also the CHIP program that provides coverage for about 150,000 kids here in Pennsylvania, does really closely track their population, the claims that they're having, whether they are seeking treatment, how much opioids they may be being prescribed, for example. And so they really do often have a good handle on their population, but actually not so much on overdose and death, because they use claims of health and healthcare services to track that information. So that coroner's data is really, really critical to actually understanding the mortality impact that the addiction crisis is having. On the commercial side, the insurance companies do similarly track their claims data. That is not traditionally shared with the state, although like we did with the first segment where we asked them to give us information on out-of-state treatment, given how important this is, we do often ask them, and they do provide data to us related to the opioid crisis. But similarly, they know who's asking for healthcare services. They know what healthcare services they're paying for, what providers are providing them, but they don't necessarily, and they know when someone unfortunately passes away, but they may not know the cause. It is really the coroners or potentially the hospitals and treating physicians who have that level of information.
And Joe, this report does include some of that information. 42% had actually, for pain medication, 8% of the patients who were admitted, or I shouldn't say admitted, that were treated for overdoses had no insurance. The good news there is that 92% did have. Where did most of their insurance derive from?
Most of the insurance is coming through the Medicaid program. One of the things that we're going to look at, though, in the future is the prevalence of this within the older population, which is something that I think doesn't get talked about a whole lot. We tend to think about drug addiction as a younger person's problem, in the same way we used to think about it as simply an urban problem. Now we know it's a rural and a suburban problem as well. But we've seen the rates for pain medication overdoses in the over 55 years of age population in Pennsylvania double over the last 2 years. And here's the really scary number. For heroin overdoses, again, we're talking about older Pennsylvanians, it's tripled. The last time I looked at these numbers in terms of age categories is about 2 years ago, and it had doubled at that point. And
when
now
you say older Pennsylvania, what age group are you talking
55
about?
Years of age and up.
Okay.
And so we're seeing more Medicare payments going into this as well. And this is a national problem of drug addiction and drug abuse as it relates to older Americans.
Yeah, when I started to speak too soon, I noticed that Medicare paid for 42% of pain medication overdoses and Medicaid only 3%. So that shows that, is that right? Only 3%? I think it's 30%. Yeah, it's 33%.
It's 33.
Yeah, but still a difference there. The Medicare showing that a lot of older people that are using that. Let's take a phone call, and I think this relates to our first part of our conversation, but I did want to get this in. Let's see. Let's go to Brad in Harrisburg. Brad, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Scott. Love your program. A quick history. I went to a doctor about 6 years ago to get treated for some pain. Within 4 months' time, he had me on the strongest and the most the highest of the dose that was allowed. About 3 months later, the doctor cut everybody that was seeing him, cut everybody off because he was getting pressured that he was writing too many opioid scripts. And of course, everybody then went and bought heroin. It's not something you can just stop doing pain pills. You go right to the heroin dealer. So fast forward several years, and I recently have tried to go to some detox centers, and some of the numbers that I got off the internet, they sit and they ask you questions, and you get the impression that they're you're going to get checked into a detox center, and they're just a consulting service, and they start trying to find you detox centers when they find out you have private insurance, which is what I have.
Hey, Brad.
The other problem, Brad, I only have about a minute. Detox centers that I ended up going to, they all use Suboxone, which is you're transferring one addiction to another.
Mm. Brad, let me ask you this. Have you gone through treatment or are you seeking treatment?
I am seeking treatment.
Let me put you on hold.
I went to a detox center, and they said that I asked one question. I said, will you keep me relatively comfortable while I am detoxing? And they said yes, and 3 days later, I'm sitting in a room going through full withdrawal, and I checked myself out, telling them I can do this at home.
Brad, let me put you on hold. We're going to try to get you some information here, okay?
Thank you.
Stay on hold. Yeah, that's one of those that, I'm glad that we did get to Brad's question. I wish it wasn't right here at the end, but maybe we can provide some information to him that he can get some legitimate questions. Joe Martin, there's so much more in this report. $32 million in payments to hospitals for overdose treatments. We still see that this is a major problem in Pennsylvania. I want to thank the three of you and our audience for participating today. And there's a lot of information here, and you can access these reports on our website, WITF.org. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about some of the challenges being faced by Pennsylvania dairy farmers. That's coming up tomorrow.